Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hi, this is Craig. Just want to let you know you can now advertise here on Everyone Loves Guitar podcast. For more information, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and we're with a really special guest today, a great guitar player and is a triple threat, a talented songwriter and a really got a beautiful voice and just a super talented artist. We're with Mike Akin. Mike's originally from Western New York, and he honed his skills playing in blues, southern rock, and country bands. Originally, he began his solo career as a songwriter and an artist when he sailed out of the cold Great Lakes and eventually to the shores of coastal Virginia, where he and his wife Amy live on their sailboat, which is really cool. He's also a U.S. Coast Guard captain, and the Akins have sailed tens of thousands of offshore miles along the Canadian Maritimes, U.S. Coast, Caribbean, and Europe. And we'll talk about that because I think that's really cool, especially for someone who, like, I can't even step on a dock without getting nauseous. it's horrible, man. It's awful. Anyway, Mike recently released his 7th studio album called Wayward Troubadour. It's a follow-up to the Grammy-nominated Captains and Cowboys, which was produced by Dan Baird from the Georgia Satellites. As the first track's title indicates, everything changed with this album. That's the name of the song. Really great record. We're going to talk about it. I listened to it. Mike also writes and produces music for Raceline, which is America's only weekly syndicated show about NASCAR racing. And he currently writes the On the Road articles for Americana Rhythm Magazine. He always finds time to give back to the community with his philanthropic projects that include the annual Akin and Friends Fest that benefits youth music education and the Great Chesapeake Bay Schooner Race, which benefits environmental concerns. He's got that coming up shortly, the 13th annual. We're going to talk about that because I think it's a really nice thing. And he's also an active endorsee for Takamine Guitars, Ovation Guitars and Mandolins, TKL Cedar Creek Custom Cases. Mike, thank you so much for time. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on. This is great.
Yeah, man. Wayward Troubadour, man. It's your 7th album. I want to congratulate you. That's a massive catalog.
Thanks very much. When you start doing this, you don't know how far you're going to be able to carry it. And I'm pretty proud that I'm still making music and putting it out, and it's relevant.
Yeah, man, you should be. That's a major accomplishment to produce one record, and in today's musical environment, to produce 7, that's amazing. I was curious, is there anything different about this record, either musically or maybe how you went about recording it or anything?
It was about 3 years in the making. And I guess there are a couple things different with it. This is self-produced, and I produced some of my early stuff and sort of got tired of myself and started hunting for another producer and went through a few people and then ended up, connecting for the last record with Dan Baird, who was amazing producer. I mean, really good. So through that sort of collaboration with Dan, I got to know him, he got to know me, and I tried to get him back on this one. And Dan was busy with his own career. So at this point, I was sort of shopping producers, took it to Texas to start recording this with somebody I knew for a long time who was going to be the producer. And we really, really butt heads. I mean, this was a longtime friend, really didn't work. Somewhere he had a stamp of where he thought I should sound like, and I had what I thought I needed to be in my head pretty clear. So I'd call Dan up and say, "Hey, Dan, here's what I'm going." He goes, "That last one that you always give me credit for," he goes, "you knew just what you wanted. I just helped you get there." He goes, "forget about it. Go produce your own record. You know what you want. You can do it." I thought that was really helpful. So went from there and I thought I would get what I need out of Austin and didn't. So we went there and tracked for a week and I ended up, throwing out all the tracks and didn't like it at all. A little costly week, but it was, but I really wanted this record to be what I believed in. I just had a real clear sound in my head of what I wanted. And you never know when you talk about 7, you never know. We put a zillion miles on, you never know what's going to be your last record. And there's a point where to me, each one has to stand up to some pretty hard critique for myself. You know, the rest of the world can say whatever they want, but at the end of it, I've got to look at it and go, I'm proud of this thing. This means something to me. So then we took it to Leapers Fork, Tennessee, about an hour south of Nashville, and a great studio. I handpicked the guys that I knew to be in the band. We went at it, and then I mixed it up with an engineer that I really like in Virginia Beach. So it was three different studios. It was quite a while to get it where I wanted it to be.
I like what you said. You never know what's going to be your last record. I like that because that's reflective of work ethic and, you know, what you want to put out there that, you know, you have pride of ownership, basically, you know, and I think that's really cool.
You know, and I'd been down the road enough, and most of my music business runs out of Nashville, and certainly, you know, I'm happy with all of them, but there are certainly ones when I was first coming in where, you know, you're a little intimidated by the machine and thinking that some of these other cats who are great players know better than you do. You know, you sort of learn and find your way. And by the time the last record and this one especially, it was, I knew what I wanted, you know, so it just had to stick to your guns and get it.
That's really cool. Some of that's a function of experience and some of that's a function of age, like being less, not being intimidated, you know, at least for myself.
Sure. I agree with you completely.
It's kind of like not that I've had to do this a lot, thank God, but the first time you have to deal with a lawyer, you know, like I had to do that for some reason. I was a kid when I was getting divorced, actually, when I was very young, and I was really intimidated. And now it's like, wait a minute, cash is flowing that way. You work for me.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yep.
I can understand that. So let's talk about a few of the tracks because I really liked it and I want to talk about some. So the first track I want to talk about is called Hangover Helper. It sounds like it got some great electric guitar. It sounds like there's some like delay or reverb on it with some distortion.
Well, there is that. Both of those depends on the guitar. I did this this record with Kenny Vaughn. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah,
with
I interviewed Vaughn. Kenny. Sure, yeah, from Marty Stewart's band. Yeah, he's a great player.
So Kenny, yeah, great player. Real intuitive. Great guy. And he plays pieces I certainly can't. I mean, he's really good and he'll play stuff out of my brain. I don't know how he does it. So on that one, we talked about where we wanted the guitars, and I'm pretty much a minimalist as far as, when I work with an engineer, let's say the engineer in Leapers Fork wanted to mix this and he made everything real lush. And I'd go, you know, my mantra recording is that needed? Does that add? Does that track add? If it doesn't add, let's not have it there. You know, if it comes down to that, what makes the song is one tambourine. Well, let's do that song.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm a real minimalist that way. And I could work with Kenny along those lines well, and we divide him to guitar parts. So on that particular song, I was doing all the slide work. On
great slide on, great slide on that song.
And Kenny was doing everything else guitar wise, you know, so we just talk about where we want the song to go. And Kenny's a tone master, you know, so he'd come in with a, you know, great reverb, you know, old, it was this weird combination amp he was telling me about, you know, he's into vintage stuff that was a combination of a Vox AC-15 and a Fender that was made for 1 year in Fullerton. You know, he'd come in with this stuff.
He's a gearhead, man.
He is, but you'd get, you know, the sound was great.
Yeah, that's really cool. Was there any particular backstory, like Hangover Helper? Was that like based on an experience that you had one night, or like you had to be somewhere and you were hungover? Or
well, it's probably based on many experiences. not saying I'm a drunk, but I am a sailor and a musician.
Sure, man.
And so on the docks, you know, there's a thing that's called when a rum front comes through. You know, it's sort of, you don't expect it. Everybody's sitting around. It's a nice evening. Before you know it, you know. You drank too much rum. A rum front came through.
Oh, rum front. That's cool. I never heard
a rum front. You know,
thank you. A rum front.
So the next morning, somebody go, "Ooh, a rum front came through, huh?" You know, and there's a few of us. So that was the next morning. Walking down the dock, and I was just thinking, you know, if they just made something like Hangover Helper, that would be really nice. You know, and it started. You know, I started writing the song within 10 minutes of that. That's where it came from. There
very
was a
cool,
particular rum front came through.
That's awesome. So. Very cool story, man. Two-lane highway. Beautiful vocals on that. And was that you singing?
You. Yeah.
Man, you know
well, what? In that one, I'm singing lead vocal. Henry Paul
Yeah, from the Outlaws.
Yeah. Is doing, you know, we gave him sort of a, he does the answer part and all the harmonies with Amy.
Very cool.
So the two of them did that. It was funny, a dream. I mean, I used to play Southern rock and Henry Paul was like, ooh, Henry Paul, you know, for me forever. Yeah. And I'd listened to that voice for so long. And my agent introduced us, Nashville. We went out to breakfast one morning. And Henry was just like the nicest guy. And then we started talking about writing. Henry goes, yeah, man, I'd like to sit down and write with you. You want to write? I said, man, love to. So it ended up, went down. He's in Atlanta these days. Went down to his studio in Atlanta and spent the weekend at his house. And we just started talking about backgrounds. And even though when the Outlaws formed, you know, that was out of Florida.
Upstate, if I remember.
But he's from upstate. Yeah.
Right, man. So, yeah.
So we start talking about experiences on farming. His grandfather owned a big truck farm, and he spent tons of his summers as a kid, you know, working the farm. And we started, we just connected in a lot of ways.
That's cool, man.
So for me, aside from, I think the song's a real good song, you know, my memories of doing it with Henry and then just connecting with this person on a human level was a ball.
That's awesome. Your voice sounded beautiful there, man. It reminded me of, man, like Jim Croce when I was listening to that.
Thanks.
It was really, and I've never heard any, you know, I've never heard like a, that's the first time I've ever thought of that in my life. It was just really very sweet, you know, it was really, really cool.
And I was after a little bit of a Jimmy Webb thing in production, you know, there's a baritone underlying it. I wanted this big landscape to sort of come out of it. Like you'd get an old, Galveston or, you know, Lyman for the County sort of production, you know, both of them are sort of haunting songs. But the production takes you to that spot. You know, I just sort of loved what they did.
It's great how you had such a clear vision for what you wanted on all these tracks.
Yeah, I can't get it out of my head. You know, sometimes it drives me crazy, but.
No, that's wonderful because it makes your life a lot easier. I mean, easier and harder, I guess, you know, harder because, you know, you've got a target and you got to hit it. And if you're not hitting it, it's frustrating. But, you know, it's cool that you have that vision going into this thing so early.
Thanks.
Dead Man Runs Before He Walks. Now, that was a haunting melody, man. And that solo in the background was great. Was that you?
No, that's Kenny. That's Kenny. He nailed it. He did. It was funny. I did the... again, I did the resonator, you know, a real simple sort of a haunting rhythm guitar that carries the song along. And then we came into that lead. And that was like Kenny's first take. He just goes in this thing. And it gave me chills. You know, we were doing it. I go, man, he goes, well, you know, want me to do some other ones? So let me hear that again. I go, no, that's done. You know, you're not going to hit it any better than that. You know, I just loved it.
Dude, kudos to you for being able to say that, you know, because it's so tempting to let's see what else you could do, but I think it's confidence and experience that behind you to do that and let them
yeah you know one. I've found from the past you can put too many ingredients in and you can kill a song by overdoing it. You know, you have to recognize when it's there.
One question, if you remember, was he playing a Strat on that? It sounded like that.
No, playing a Tele.
His Tele, yeah.
He came in with about three different Teles.
That's a selection to him. Three different Teles.
You know, and those it's funny, we were talking. So we were cutting it, and like within 2 days after we got done working, you know, he was on the road with Marty in Ireland, I think. So I was talking to him, he goes, well, you know, these are guitars I got laying around home, but all my good ones are on the road, you know, we shipped them over. You know, I don't know how many he's got, but he walked in with three really vintage, really cool Teles, and he could get a lot out of them. They're all the pickup select. You know, one was set up with humbuckers, one was set up with standard Tele pickups. I mean, they were just set up to get what he wanted.
Yeah, he's a master. So I'm assuming right now what you're spending most of your time doing is working on promoting the record.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. You know, you put all the time and effort into it. It is time to work it. And that's what your life turns into at that point.
What does that involve for you? What does promotion look like for you?
For me, it's, you know, you're hiring a publicist. I've got a record promoter in the U.S., a record promoter and publicist in Europe. And it is, you know, just you know, just working it. I guess that's it. You know, every day you're getting up and working it, and then going out and playing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of road time.
And your wife works with you a lot.
Yeah, the way actually Amy's in the band, plays you know, backup vocals, all sorts of percussion and drums, depending on the configuration, but she plays all sorts of stuff. So we're on the road all the time that way together. A lot of times we're out doing, you know, smaller duo shows. Hmm. Europe is as a duo.
That's
Europe's
cool.
pretty expensive to go over, so that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
And she also owns the record label I'm on, you know, so sometimes I'm just a chunk of meat on the table.
Nice. I feel bad for you. Hey, man, go ahead.
That comes from years ago, being a bunch younger and sort of getting caught in a jam with Capricorn Records when they were going under and losing a bunch of money. And then going off and going sailing and coming back and said, if I do this again, I'm going to build control into it. And that's where years ago we set up our own label so I could control things.
You know, Good for you. Do you know how many people I've interviewed that have got that really just got screwed by Capricorn? I mean, it was prolific.
Yeah, yeah. You know, everybody was, you know, they were it. They were the label. And it looked like they were still building, and all of a sudden they were done. You know, yeah. it was tough.
But they had so many people that really should have been, you know, marquee. You know, like I interviewed, you know, Tommy Talton from Cowboy?
I know who he is. I don't know him personally.
You know, that band had everything going for him, and they just dropped the ball. And another guy, Ian Moore, it was just like they really screwed everything up.
Yeah. Yep.
Very nutty. Hey, so you're from Western New York. What was your childhood like? And you grew up in a little tiny town, I think you told me last time we spoke.
I did. You know, I ended up in Bennington, New York. Wasn't a post office. We shared a post office with Darien, New York. You know, for me, it was a great childhood. My folks were, you know, a little background. My mother's, she's dead now, but she was French, came over with a different way of looking at things, came over after World War II. And that was a pretty tough time for her. So she came to the States because it was the country where the liberators were from, really. Yeah. At a young age, at 17, she came over alone to try to just get out of a war-torn country and a lot of family loss. My dad was from Canada and came down, was in the States. So they met and they were really just blue collar, hardworking folks. And we moved around a lot. My dad would buy a house that was really let go, move the family into it. So I've got one brother and we'd all work on it. I mean, you're working, excuse me, working all the time as a child of my father. You know, if you could pick up a paintbrush, you were doing something.
Yeah.
And so we moved around and, you know, I think by the time I was in third grade, I was in 7 school systems, but just within that area.
Yeah.
So that's how, you know, that's they did it the old school way and, you know, became successful upper middle class folks.
But you learned how to hustle at a young age, which is such a valuable skill set, man.
It is. And learn how to, for me, it learned how to be
entrepreneurial.
Yeah, that, and learn how to be, you know, comfortable as a loner.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have those same friends all through, you know, all through your school time, all that. And that's probably the biggest thing with me, with this wayward troubadour, any of it, is for Amy and I, as long as we're on the go, we're happy. Hmm. You know, if it's on the boat, we're happy. If it's, you know, if we're, you know, we're on the road all the time, we're happy that way. If, you know, you get off the road, there'll be a point where you've been gone for a month or something. You're pushing. You go, man, if it would just be nice to be home. Well, that's good for about 3 days. 3 days. I'm going like, okay, now what are we doing? You know, that's just our nature.
Yeah. You have a hard time sitting still.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you find, because I'm like this and it's a blessing and a curse, like I measure like how good a day I had by how much I got done, which is like awful. Like I said, it's a blessing and a curse, you know?
It's funny. It is a blessing and a curse. And I do all the time. I'm the type of guy that's always got about 3 lists going and yellow pads all over with that stuff. You know, just,
right.
I like accomplishment. And I like it a couple different ways. The music stuff can be sometimes so hard to feel what you accomplish during a day of promotion and all that.
Yeah. There's no measurable. I mean, it's not, there's not as much measurable Yeah, it's hard to tell the impact of certain things that you do. I can understand that. Yeah,
it is. And I've always had some other things where I do physical stuff, you know. Well, this would have come out in some of these questions later, but as a young age, I used to shoe horses for a living. I had a bunch of horses, big farm, all this stuff. And now, same thing. I do sailboat rigging. I love climbing masts and being up in the rigging. And it's sometimes that is so nice to get away from the music and do something. You turn around and go, oh, I just actually did this thing and I can physically see it.
Right.
You know, there's that pleasure of accomplishment for that type of thing.
And it's measurable. You can know how much work, you know what it looked like before and what it looks like now, or how much. I totally get that. Yeah. It's funny. So for me, when I relax, I go play music and I don't care about anything. Once I do that, the clock is just off and it's just, you know, because I'm not a professional. So I don't, that is my hobby. With you guys, it's hard because your hobby is your vocation.
Right.
Yeah, which makes it tough. Man, I give your mom credit, 17 coming over here.
Yep, she was tough.
Yeah, what an awesome woman. That's real. My wife was like that. She's from the UK, and of course it wasn't coming over here after the war, but she came over here when she was like, I think, in her early 20s. You know, I think that's a ballsy move. I don't know if you could do that nowadays. Of course they wouldn't.
I think people do that all the time. I mean, I think from here, we're pretty comfortable in this country, but a lot of the people coming to this country, you know, trying to escape a harder life somewhere else are doing that. You know, I think that happens.
Was playing guitar your original dream, or like, were you planning on doing something else, like, you know, flipping houses or something?
No, probably guitar just captured me. And writing, I'd have to say pretty equal with it was being able to communicate a story. So the first person to turn me onto it was, I was probably in second grade, and it was, you know, a little elementary school, and a teacher, actually her name was Mrs. Huff. I don't know why I remember that, but I do. And she would, after school, she'd bring in about 10 ukuleles and say, does anybody want to learn how to play this? And she'd offer these free, and you'd sit around, and as soon as I realized that you could play a few chords and there was a story to tell. So she was doing all these old folk songs and this stuff. That's what sold it for me. I mean, I took violin lessons. I took keyboard lessons. That keyboard's a good thing to know, but it didn't really resonate with me the same way as having a small instrument you could take with you and tell a story.
Do you consider yourself more a songwriter who plays guitar? Like the guitar is the means to your end?
Oh, or does it vacillate? Really, it vacillates. I mean, in a younger day, when I was just part of a band, I was a lead player for years. Hmm. And I loved, you know, just trying to get your chops up. So I liked being a good player. I like constantly working on it. But I guess the songwriter part, that you can really touch somebody's heart a little bit differently, you know, and get – And maybe ease somebody's pain or ease somebody's life a little bit for 3 minutes. I really like being able to do that.
That's awesome. So. I have a very long-winded question here. I'm going to try to summarize it. Last time we spoke, you told me a story about something that you wound up quitting a band and you thought it would destroy your career, but ultimately it led you to having a much stronger and more fulfilling career. And it reminded me afterwards, you know, I have this expression, you can't connect the dots moving forward, and shit happens all the time. And we don't know, like a lot of times we think it's, oh my God, it's the end of the world. And it turns out to be, wow, that was a cool thing because it opened the door for this or that. So if you're okay, man, I'd Absolutely. Love you to tell that story. It was a really cool thing.
Well, sure. So, there was a time when we were putting together, just a real quick extra.
Yeah, take your time.
The same, I bought this boat in Florida, you know, sort of down on its luck, but bought this boat to sail to Europe alone. And that was my plan. And the same week I bought the boat, I met Amy.
Wow.
And her plan was to hike the Continental Divide. So then she goes, oh, a boat sailing to Europe. I think that would work. So that sort of started that.
So you guys had that chemistry that quick when you met. That's awesome, man. I was like,
shockingly, yes.
No, that's wonderful. I had the same. My wife, that's electric, man.
And if you would have told me that that could happen the day before that, you know, I would have called bullshit on it, you know. And
like I said, you can't connect the dots moving forward, man.
So that happened. And then I was, you know, as we're working on this boat, and you don't just take something like sailing the North Atlantic lightly. And we were going up to the Canadian Maritimes, a lot of ice, and you don't take it lightly. And our philosophy is, if you're going up for personal pleasure, which is really what that is, you don't have the right to call somebody to bail you out. You know, so we look at it as we're going to get there or not, but we're going to get there on our own. You know, mm-hmm. calling, the, I don't know, the Coast Guard to send a swimmer and put their life on the line. If it's commercial, if you're out there working commercial, to me, it's a different thing. But if you're just going out there playing, you know, you don't have that right. You got to be more self-sufficient than that. So long story is, we're putting a lot of work onto this boat, and I'm being the guy in a band that I hate. You know, I'm being the guy that's coming to rehearsals not prepared, doing this stuff. So I finally had to say, you know, guys, I'm, you know, let me find somebody to replace me. I'll teach them the parts, but, you know, I don't want to be at the end of this. I don't want you to hate me because I'm dropping the ball all the time. So I thought that was really going to turn into, I'm going sailing, that was going to be the end of just a youthful career, and I was killing it. That's really what I thought was going to go on. So then we left, and it really put a focus on writing a lot more. You know, I spent more alone time, not leaning on a band, and hearing a lot of other people's music. And, you know, and in the end, when we came back to the States, and, you know, I always look at it as a Blues Brothers thing. I came back with a, you know, with a suitcase full of songs, beer. You know, yeah. With just the songs. All of a sudden, by the time we came back, we were gone. We left the country and we're gone. You know, we'd come back to visit, but pretty much 10 years we disappeared. Spent a bunch of time in Europe, a bunch of time in the Caribbean, and pretty much went off the radar. But when I came back, there are all these tunes just, you know, just waiting to come out. And that wouldn't have happened if I didn't leave the band scenario, you know. So we started, you know, I performed throughout, you know, Canada and Portugal and Europe and the Caribbean on you know, on a real basic level. And that helped. That helped a lot.
What a great story, man.
And it also gave you, you started to learn to be more observant of what was around you. When you're just in a band and you're just, you know, working that night, it becomes a job. And to me, I just wasn't as observant as going out on the boat, pulling into a port. You're the stranger all the time in those foreign ports. You know, you're the stranger, and you observe how other things are going. And that lesson of being observant, I think, really helped my writing.
What a great story. I have some follow-up questions to that.
Sure.
First thing you said, you mentioned that self-sufficiency thing. I am so steadfast on how important that is to, for anybody, like for your life in general. Like, I couldn't imagine, like, not, you know, waiting for somebody else to, like, fix your shit or anything like that. You know, I think it's so important that you take care of yourself. And this way, if the consequences one way or another, it's on you, which you could fix. You know, it's not like, well, something happened because I let somebody else, you know. And I think that's such a, not to get off on a tirade, but I think that's such an important thing. And I think if people were more self-sufficient, they'd bitch a lot less, and the everything
absolutely
would just go smoother, man.
Yeah, I mean, place the responsibility on your shoulders instead of whining and saying somebody else should have done it. You know?
Yeah, right. Well, like, that's like whining about the price of lettuce. You know, like, it's nothing you're going to fix. You know.
Well, what happened with sailing is, and I'll take it to that, is technology advanced so fast. You know, and there was a time when Amy and I were sailing, and mainly it was due to lack of funds, but we were still doing celestial navigation. You really did it that way. And once GPS is, you know, you can, it's on your phone, you can get that technology so cheap.
It's crazy.
That it has put people out at sea that don't have the skill, really shouldn't be there, and they have a false sense of security because their GPS gives them a route from, I don't know, Norfolk, Virginia, around Hatteras to the Bahamas or the Caribbean or whatever. And those folks, because they didn't have to go through the years of really learning how to do it, they just think they can because they can buy their little tool. Yeah. And they're the ones that are out there in the fall of every year calling somebody to save their asses when they just shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
They have a false sense of confidence. And for me, that thing of going, you know, and I talked to those folks. There's a bunch of rallies that leave out of the Chesapeake. What's going to happen? I look at a boat and go, well, you know, this thing's not ready for sea. What's going to happen? Oh, I'm just going to call somebody to come and get me. Well,
it's total opposite wrong. Of self-sufficiency, right?
Yeah. So
you also, I don't know anything about this, so I have some questions which may be like real stupid or ignorant, and I apologize.
There are no questions like that.
Well, you may be surprised. when you're sailing, like how far off for wherever, you know, land mass you are, how far away from land are you at any given time?
There's two answers for that. You're always about a mile and a half straight down.
Okay.
That's your closest land mass is the bottom and where you never want to go, you know. Otherwise, let's say from here to the Azores, go to mainland Portugal, you know, that's 2,000 miles away approximately. So you're 1,000 miles from any land coastwise when you're in the middle. So it's, you know, it's
holy smokes.
You know, so you're out there. I mean, our longest passage to date was from the Canary Islands to Antigua, and that was 24 days at sea, you know, and a few thousand miles.
That's amazing. I find that like so intimidating. It's like you really got to know what you're doing, man.
It's intimidating and it's enthralling and it's and you learn a different respect to me for real power. I mean, when you're in a North Atlantic storm, and we've had our asses handed to us a number of times. When you're in a North Atlantic storm and that sort of power, well, a hurricane, when that sort of power hits you, it to me it became the benchmark for what power is, you know, compared to people that act real powerful.
You know,
that's real power, you know, and it is intimidating. It can be absolutely, you know, it's not on this record. A couple records ago, I wrote a song called One More Night. And that was a story really that I was writing, really to Amy is where it came from. But we were in the storm and that's what, you know, you'd go to sleep at night and that's what it was, one more night. And we said that to, you know, I said it to myself, quite a few nights in a row, and we were really in it. And it was just like, one more night. Well, that's all I need is one more night. And then, you know, you do that often enough, one foot forward. But and a side story on that, on the songwriting thing. So years after that, in Norfolk, you get all these, you get all these service people that come back. You're coming back home. And I met this woman that got a hold of me. She knew the name, and she asked if I would look at a boat with her. So, okay, I didn't really know what was going on. Go and look at this boat with her. And it turned out she was a Marine sergeant who was in real bad situations. And she ended up admitting me. She was buying that boat as sort of an escape for herself. But she goes, you know what got me through? I said, what's that? She goes, that song of yours, One More Night.
Wow. Go,
oh, fuck. You know, I mean,
that was cool. I just got goosebumps, man. That's heavy shit. That's awesome.
And for me, that was payday. You know, wow. You can't get paid. If you can help somebody through, oof, you know.
Holy smokes, man. I have goosebumps. That's a really cool story. Thank you. Wow. Thank you very much. When you first started playing professionally, were there any big surprises for you as it relates to the business end of the music industry?
You know, all sorts. I guess at the point, you know, when you're a kid playing, it's all just heart and it's all just excitement. And when you start realizing how much of it is a business, I think the thing you have to learn is to separate those two. You know, there is music and there's the business of music. And if you let the business of music overshadow the excitement of being a musician, it kills you. You know, you see a lot of musicians sort of give up and go away from that. It's pretty, you know, it'll squash you fast. But that's really, and you realize how much of a business it is. And it's a pretty heartless business when you get to the business side of it. So you can't let that kill your inspiration and kill what you're trying to do with the thing you love.
Let me ask you about that, because I've heard that, I've had conversations, you know, on the show and then off air about that with loads of people. How is it that everybody that gets involved I would think everybody that gets involved, or most of the people that get involved in the music business, are there because they like music, you know, because there's something about putting on a song and feeling a certain way that says, man, I have a connection here. Now, in theory, most of the people that have that motivation, you'd think are like pretty good people, but that's not the way it works. And I've heard that pretty consistently. Why does, like, what is, how do you think like that happens? Like, you know, all the rats get in and turn it into a rat race.
You know, I think it's an opportunist situation. I think people come in because they love the music. You know, like, let's say Nashville is just prime for that. You have to be so careful in Nashville, especially when you're coming in new. I mean, it's just a feeding frenzy. And you have people that love the music, but maybe don't have a music skill, but still, I mean, really love the music. And they want to be in it, and they to find a niche to pay their mortgage with and stay in the music industry. And they look around and say, you know, which direction is the music flowing and the money flowing, and sort of get in it. It's just tough. You know, and I don't think it comes from a lack of the love of music. It comes from trying to find a spot if they don't have the skill to make the music.
Yeah.
To stay in it. You know, and then you have people that are, you know, that just have been in it a long time. They get hardcore to it. It can be a real hustle. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I hear that pretty consistently from all ends and all, you know, all ages and all types of musicians. So it's unfortunate. What are some of the bigger obstacles you've had to overcome throughout this journey, either personally or music related or business related?
Well, you know, we talked about the Capricorn thing. So there's been some business ones that way, financially realizing, you know, one was, and we sort of knew it going in, but you don't know till you're really in it. You know, how does music get played on the radio? You know, and a lot of people think, oh, I make a good record and I put it out there and they're going to play it. Well, that's not how it goes, you know? So we were just sort of referencing it. There were some of those where you learn those lessons and you have to step back and go, am I going to let that kill my creativity? And you can't. For me, I can't. I see a lot of people along the roadside, not literally the roadside, but, you know, along it kills them. It kills their creativity. They become, you know, everything's about the money about it. For me, the money has, you know, you got to make money, but the money has not ever been the biggest focus of it. You know, that might not be the smartest thing on my part, but for me, the music's always been a thing, you know, so.
I that's pretty consistent, like, I think among 99.99% of musicians out there, you know, unless I've been super fortunate, because that's, you know, it's just not congruent to be up on stage doing what you do, making somebody feel something and you becoming vulnerable and expressing thoughts you have and thinking about money at the same, that's like,
yeah,
it's a very incongruent thing.
Where you see it more is like with side players, you know, people that have really studied to be a fast guitar player, a great drummer, but they don't have maybe they don't have the connection to the song. You know, they're your side players. You put a band together.
Sure.
And sometimes you'll have those folks. They're great players. They've worked real hard to get there. And it's about, what am I getting paid for this gig? And it's all about just getting paid for the gig and going home.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's not heart. So you work your way through who you're going to have working with you to get the right people to put a feel off from the stage. You know, and that's a hard lesson as far as growing up and doing it. One of the ones is it's almost who's the best. You know, you do auditions or you're working with people. And a lot of time, it's not the guy who's the flashiest player. It's the guy who's really good in hang time in the bus. You know, he can be three quarters of the player, but when the bus is broken down, you know, you don't have somebody whining and complaining and crying. You got a good person with you.
Yeah.
And when that happens, all those times you know, that you've gone through that, and everybody does.
Sure.
Well, that comes out positive on stage because you're connected as a band and you're,
yeah,
you really get the music across.
I hear that consistently too. You know, the music's an hour or two a day. The other 22, 23 hours is the hang. And yeah, if you're miserable, it's really miserable for everybody. You know,
yep.
I hear that.
Yep.
And I must say, in reference to your last comment, I've been really fortunate because I have to tell you, 99% of the Sidemen I've interviewed are so grateful to be able to do that, to play music. And I know that there are guys out there that are looking at it for the money. I've been really fortunate that I have not run across very many of them, to be honest with you.
And I can't knock those guys. You know, they've got families and kids and they've got bills. I mean, I can't knock it, but it's not what I want to be surrounded with.
Well, again, it's not congruent with what you need to communicate your vision of your music.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I totally get that. And I can understand the trying to balance that out. Hey, just talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to guitar right now? You play a bunch of different ones, I know. And maybe what are your top three altogether?
All right. Yeah,
now you're smiling big time, man.
That's a tough question because I love guitars. And it's interesting. If you get in a slump writing, get a different guitar.
Man, I mean,
each one of them speaks to you differently. They just do. You know, if you're in a slump, you pick up a different guitar and all of a sudden you think different, you play different. It's really helpful. So, but to try to narrow it down, on sort of an electric side, I play a 66 Gretsch Tennessean.
Wow.
And that's just a beautiful guitar. When I was a kid, I had a bunch of them, sold them. Didn't know any better. And so I started searching actually for this last record for this guitar, and you found it's vintage, but not all vintage is good.
Oh yeah.
And in those, you know, if you got the right one, it just is beautiful. And there are a lot, you know, I went through a lot of guitars to find the right one, but that one speaks to me real well as an electric guitar. Do you have that nearby?
I'd love to see it if you have it nearby, if it's handy. If it's not, no worries.
Well, hang on now.
Yeah, just
take a little walk.
Let's go see
take
that.
A little walk
I'd like
here.
To see it. Where did you get this?
Actually, I got it at Carter Vintage Guitars.
Yeah, I knew you'd Walter
in Nashville.
Yeah, I knew you'd Walter like 300 episodes ago.
Yeah, so they've sold. Let me see here. I'm gonna point you at this. Is a pile I brought in.
Nice. Guitars. Nice.
And let's get to that one.
Thank you, man. So I appreciate you. This is a
custom case that Cedar Creek built just for this guitar for me.
Very cool. Shout out to Cedar Creek. There you go.
Yep. Oh, they treated me just, they're great folks.
Man, I'm excited just watching you unbox it. Wow.
There it is. Isn't that beautiful?
Man, that is, so let me just describe it. It's like a Tennessee and it's got two F holes. It's like a wood, like not chestnut. What color is that?
Actually it's maple. But I don't know. I think it was more of an orangey color when it was made, and it's faded into that.
Oh, man, that is gorgeous. Wow. And are those – I'm assuming those are stock pickups?
They are. They are stock. What Gretsch's usually come with are these pickups called Filtertrons, and that's sort of their trademark. But they made a few – Filtertrons are humbuckers, if we're getting into gear – are humbuckers, but they made a few of these single coils, and these are called high-low-trons.
So those are single coils?
Yeah, those are single coils, big fat single coils. But they're not like a P90. They don't quite act like that, but they're called high-low-trons, and they are so chimey and just beautiful.
Man, that is great. It's got a Bigsby on it, and is that a rosewood neck or ebony? It looks like rosewood here. Right?
That's rosewood.
Man, what a beautiful guitar. Wow. You know, the orange, the faded orange is really cool because you never see something that looks like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't. Let's see here.
Wow. And it's really slim.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's beautiful. And it's cool because I can actually cover, you know, it's you know, semi-hollow in there. But I can actually cover a fair amount of acoustic. It's with a real clean, and if I'm doing like Texas swing type stuff, I can make that thing, you know, get a right hand thumb pick thump, you know.
That's awesome.
Going out of Texas swing stuff, the guitar responds. You can do so much with it. Yeah, I love that one.
Man, thank you for showing me that. That's a beautiful guitar. Wow, what a cool looking
acts, man.
All right, now we're busting out
the whole Aiken collection. That's cool, man. Very cool. That's a beautiful case also, man. That looks like you could throw that thing on the airport thing and it would be safe.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Another TKL piece. So this is, I do a lot of open tuning stuff, but that's a pretty weird piece.
Wow. What is that? Like a,
it's a national, hang on. So, and that one's with me every night also. It's a National Res Electric.
What year is that?
It's like mid-90s, I think. I think it was something like maybe 92, 94, something like that. And it's just, you know, National builds some funky guitars.
Yeah. It's got switches all over the place, man. Is that like a P90?
That's a P90. And then there's a Highlander Piezo, and if you're familiar with the resonators, that's called a biscuit under there.
Yeah.
It's floating in the resonator pan. So there's two, and all this thing has really, you have volume for the bridge, for the neck pickup.
Right.
Volume for the bridge and a master volume. There's no tone controls on this thing at all. All you got is volumes. And then, you know, pickup and selectors.
And the knobs are really weird. They're what do they call those?
The chicken head?
Yeah, chicken heads. You don't usually see that on a guitar.
No, you don't.
That's a really cool looking piece. And it's like it looks like mint green, or it's just worn, you know, the pick guard there, or the neck guard, it looks like even.
Yeah, it was sort of creamy, and it's sort of gotten this weird, yeah, greenish thing come happening.
It looks great, man. Wow.
That's just a, for me, it really suits my style. I'll just sit this one down somewhere.
When you're on the boat, do you take these guitars?
No. I had in where the boat is, Norfolk, Virginia, we've got an office in a boatyard that I store a bunch of stuff at. The boat, the salt water and the humidity kills them. I took an old Martin with me when we crossed the Atlantic years ago on that trip, and it about, you know, killed the neck. The frets were coming out. It just killed it. I had it brought back, but
yeah.
So I'll keep a guitar on the boat all the time, but you can't keep your good stuff there.
Just like some cheapo acoustic thing that you can plunk out, write songs.
Yeah,
on.
Well, it's not through the Takamine folks. They've hand built me quite a few guitars, so it's a good guitar. And sort of Takamine's thing is, build guitars that can really build a good guitar that can withstand a lot. So I've got one of theirs on.
That's great, man. Those are beautiful guitars. So what would be your number three?
Number three would be a Takamine. I don't even have that one with me, but I've got a hand-built OM style Takamine acoustic that they built for me. So I'll give you a little story behind resonator.
Yeah.
Kind of story. So Amy and I came in from, I think we left the boat in Spain, flew back, and I was getting the Martin looked at. And we go to this luthier, the shop that I knew in Rochester, New York, called Stutzman's. And that resonator's hanging on the wall. And we were broke. I wouldn't even look at it. You know, I knew this guy really well. And so I went in to see if I could get this Martin fixed. So, you know, I just wouldn't even look at it. So I'm in the back in the shop part. And Amy walks in with that guitar in her hand. She goes, "Did you see this?" I said, "Yeah, I saw it, but man, I can't. Nah, I didn't even want to touch it because if I touch it, I want it." She goes, "You should own this thing." She puts it in my hand. And needless to say, I walked out with it, you know. So
that's awesome, man. but you know what, man? This is about you, but my wife is the same way. And I can't tell you how, you know, when you have somebody supporting you like that, it's a different, I mean, it's like, I know you feel the same way because I've talked to you about this a little bit, man. You just feel like the luckiest dude on earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Know? That's for sure.
Yep. And that just like gets you through a lot of shit to have somebody support. No, I mean, it does, man. And it's like a, you know, real, and I know you don't take that for granted, you know?
No, you can't.
No.
Yeah, that's for sure.
No,
that's
that would be sure. Like a sin to take like that for granted. Yep. That's a, you know, that's a once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, thing, man. That's really cool. What a great story, man. That's very cool. Thank you, man.
Anybody who's influenced your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
For me, you know, I've listened to so many different types. And again, it goes, you know, I love playing slide. So of course I listen to all the Duane Allman stuff, did that. And they influence it to a point of technique and style. But one of the big ones is Taj Mahal.
Ah.
Taj Mahal is a fantastic player. I like playing roots country, and he's done so much of that. He brings in that, you know, African Caribbean thing that way before people thought it was a hip thing to do, Taj was doing that. He's just a gracious guy. I don't know if you've ever been around Taj. He's just
In Nashville there. Have you played with him?
No, I haven't. I've met him in L.A., and we talked. And actually, we talked about sailing. He's a big-time sailor, too.
That's funny.
So we didn't talk about music or guitars at all. We talked about sailing.
That's cool.
And but he's a big influence on the way of the honesty he approaches it with. You know, so that was one. That's really a tough one. Doc Watson.
Oh yeah.
Just because he's Doc Watson and his finger picking comes across. And I think another one who's a big influence of guitar, and most people wouldn't think it, would be John Prine. Because John Prine, he's not trying to be out there as a flashy guy.
No.
But John Prine, his right hand, his guitar playing helps him to get those songs out. I think he's a brilliant player. But he's not trying to be the side guy flashy, but you listen to something that Prine does and you're taken in by the song. And then you go, what's the method he's delivering this through? And it's that sounding so simplistic, but spot on to deliver that lyric.
Can you give me a song of his that I should listen to? Cause I want to check some of his stuff out.
He's got a bunch. He's got a new record out, but like on the old stuff, let me think of one that I think really works. Old People.
Old People.
Song called Old People.
I'll check that out. Thank you.
And you listen to that finger picking, and you know, it doesn't take you long before you forget he's playing guitar. You're wrapped up in the song. But I look at that and go, how is he getting that to work? You know, not just the lyrics, how's he making that work? And he's been, to me, influential as a guitar player that way.
Great, thank you.
Not just from flash and speed of notes or bending technique or any of that. Just
well, that's not you. You're not
how he does it.
You're not that guy. You're a melody guy. Right. You write to serve the song. Your fills and everything serves the music that you wrote it for. You're not a guitar guy. You know, people aren't listening to your music to hear all the riffs. I'm not saying that, you know what I'm saying. They're wonderful, but that's not why people listen to you. You're delivering a certain message and a heart and soul and a melody and in the way you're putting it together that makes people feel good. And it's not got nothing to do with the guitar playing.
You know, you listen to, let's say, old blues guys. There's Gary Moore out of England who was like super flash player. I mean, great, amazing technique.
Yeah.
And I'd listen to that and go, And then you'd listen to like Freddie King.
Oh.
And Freddie King would play one note.
Yeah, that guy's such
a monster. And tear your heart out where Gary Moore would 1,000 would have gone by in that time. And I always gravitated to Freddie King. I go, how does he do that with three notes? You know, somehow that's what drew me.
His attack was phenomenal because he had the finger picks. You know, he had the metal thumb pick, I think, the metal thumb pick and the metal index finger. And he was brutal. I mean, I feel the same. Of all the old blues guys, he's my guy simply for his tone that he got. And you can't get that unless you're him. You
know,
of
course. Yeah.
So who would be your third? You said Doc Watson, John Prine.
And Taj Mahal.
And Taj Mahal. Great.
Players that really, I think, really influenced me. I mean, and I've listened to like all of them and you take in everybody's stuff, but a lot, it was approach to a song probably as what I'd study in the guitar is approach to a song of all of them.
And I'm going to ask you this because since we're close in age, I know you've bought records. Do you remember the first record you bought?
Oh, first record.
Or the first record someone bought for you, perhaps?
You know, probably the first record that that I went and bought after was probably Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore.
What a record. That's a great baptism record. You know, if you got a wow.
And you go, oh, my God, you know.
Yeah, that's a great record. Have you ever checked out, you know, when they released the CD of the full, the whole concert?
It was, no, I have not.
Now, I'll be honest with you. The stuff they captured on the record, that was the best songs. But there's just, they expanded the fidelity of it a little bit, which was really nice. But, I mean, what a record, man. What an incredible album. That album, I've had so many guys have interviewed say, my guitar teacher told me, you learn live, go listen to Live at the Fillmore and start learning that and you'll know how to play guitar.
Yeah.
Desert Island Discs, Mike, if you had to pick three, no particular order, and just for today, you know, what would be the first knee-jerk reaction to three things that come to mind?
All right. I don't know if you ever heard a band called Great Big Sea.
No, I have not.
Great Big Sea is out of and I think they're
hey, you talk about say that again.
You first just, time I saw
you broke up a bit. Great Big Sea and Alasha.
Oh, they're out of Newfoundland. St. John's, oh, wow. Newfoundland is where the band's from. And first time I saw them, much later, they're an acoustic band, and they gave me that same sense of, I couldn't believe it, of power that the Allman Brothers would, seeing them live in the day. They were so powerful. There was a guy called Bob Halleck, his name, and he played all sorts of accordions, fiddle, flutes, tin whistles. This is sort of a, you know, like a Celtic folk rock sort of band, I guess, with a bunch of maritime stuff thrown in. And then a guy, Sean McCain, and he did acoustic and Bo-Ron, you know, did that cool Bo-Ron thing. And then Alan Doyle, who was probably the main lead guy, did Bouzouki, a bunch of different acoustics, great voice and an acoustic bass player. But the band is phenomenal. The writing is great. Their harmonies are great. So,
and C is spelled
S E A.
S E A. Great Big. I want to. Okay, hold on 1 second because you are describing a band that sounds exactly like an Irish band. And give me 1 second. I mean, literally the same thing. And I guarantee you know it. Let me just look this up here because they were a pretty big band and they're like a jam band is what you're describing, with the same, with the flute, Moving Hearts. Have you ever heard of them?
No, I don't know that name.
Yeah. They're a band out of Ireland. It sounds exactly like the same thing. They, with the flutes and all and Bouzouki and all, you know, big, massive bunch of people in it too.
You'd get that. I mean, Newfoundland was really, there's, you know, really Irish descendants and, you know, fishermen, for the most part, for livelihood.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So you sort of get that. But if you ever have a chance, look up a Great Big Sea.
I
just
am.
Great stuff.
I circled this in red. So that's my to-do list. What would be another one?
Probably next one would be, now would be probably Jason Isbell. I think Jason Isbell is really a phenomenal writer. You know, that Southeastern is record's great. Just great. I really like his stuff. And it takes somebody a while to get me to accept him, I guess. You know, it isn't like a flash in a pan, and he just puts out consistently great stuff.
Yeah.
And I love it. And the other one was probably Taj Mahal, that Natural Blues, and actually Recycle the Blues and Other Stuff, I think is the one where he does with the Pointer Sisters. And it's just this mix of, you know, it's the first time I heard somebody starts that record out blowing a conch shell. And I go, what is that? I dig that. Then I saw him in concert where he just comes out alone. And now here's a poor fitting. I go to see Mothers of Invention and Taj Mahal's the opening act. And of course, Mothers were with the Mothers were and Frank Zappa. But Taj walks out alone. Walks out and opens the show. It blew me away. But he was bringing in that seafaring stuff. And then he took you to Africa. And then he took you to the Caribbean. And then he took you, you know, to American, you know, blues. The guy's phenomenal, you know, so.
That's, you know what? Do you know a guy named Ricky Hirsch from Wet Willie?
I know the name. I don't know him, but I know the name.
He was just telling me last week Natural Blues. He sold me the same album. He recommended it to me literally last week. He said it was the same exact reaction. He says, you got it. It's phenomenal stuff. So that's on my to-do list.
And that cool. has been, you listen to something like off the new record of mine, you listen to Traveling Bone.
Yeah.
That song, Traveling Bone. A lot of Taj influence in that. You know, just to the setup of a song, the rhythm guitar behind it, you know, what I'm using a resonator on that too. But there's a lot of Taj influence on that song.
Very cool, man. Thank you for sharing that. So this is a tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself, Mike?
That is a tough question.
It's a tough one, man. I know.
I think I like that that I keep looking forward all the time. You know, I don't think I'm a whiny guy, and I keep looking for a new good thing. I'm pretty idealistic that way.
You also strike me as the kind of guy, if you say something, it's done. Like, you know.
Well, that's, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you don't need a contract if you say, yeah, that's going to happen. If you say no, it's not going to happen.
That's exactly how I am.
Yeah. How about the flip side, man? If you could change something about yourself, what would it be?
That's a tough one too. It would probably be maybe, especially in the past, I was a real, real wise ass in schools, you know, high school and all. And I wish I would have understood what they were trying to give me. It was free. One of the few things, free. You know, music teachers that were trying to teach me. Language teachers that were trying to teach me. And I was just a wise ass.
Yeah. So I hear you. Well, that's pretty impressive that the thing that you'd want to change about yourself was something like when you were 17, which like who doesn't have a laundry list of stuff that they wouldn't want to change about themselves when they were a teenager, you know?
And that would have changed so much other things. You know, there would have been
Yeah. Well, thank you. something or someone you miss from your childhood.
I think if it's something, an innocence, which I try to maintain, but that feeling that everything is obtainable, everything is ready there for you, you know?
Right, right.
So I try hard to maintain that it's a beautiful world and most of it's beautiful people, and you just have to open up to that.
Yeah. And you have to work at that. You can't just blindly, have that attitude. You really have to work. I find for me anyway, you got to work at that and you got to make that a priority and you got to consciously, again, just for me, I always have to say, look at the benefits of behaving and thinking like that because it's work.
I'll tell you, Toosters, this goes into, you know, that sort of the hero thing, but another story, it's attitude. You have to realize when you're starting to change and stop it. But like, so my dad viewed life as, I will not trust somebody till they prove to me that they can be trusted.
Yeah.
Okay. That was his view. There was a guy that goes into this heroes thing. Captain Lane Briggs, we spent a lot of time with, and I can go into that more, but Captain Lane, we spent a lot of sailing time with Lane. And I remember sitting in Captain Lane's wheelhouse, and this guy was amazing. And he told me his philosophy was he would trust everybody till they proved he couldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, just 180 degrees different than how my dad looked at it. And Captain Lane, we spent probably the last 2 years of his life. Amy and I spent a lot of time with him. And he was at a point of reflection and looking at it. And I said, well, how'd that work out for you, you know, Cap? And he goes, man, if I could put that on a scale of the people that took advantage of me compared to the people that gave back because I treated them that way, he goes, you know, the scales would be tipped so much to the good.
That's
goes,
great.
You know, so that was one. He would, you know, he consciously looked at how he wanted to be with people and the life he wanted to lead around them, you know.
Well, too, as you get older, you want to be open to trusting people, but you also get red flags of, okay, you know, I've got a reason not to deal with this person, so let me pass. But if you have no reason, you go and like, why not give somebody a shot? I always try to do that. Like, I always figure, and not from an arrogant way, but I will trust you until you prove I'm not. But I also look at it, you've got a lot better, you're a lot smarter doing the right thing by me because you have a good ally in me, you know. So if you want to blow that's totally cool, man. It's your prerogative, you know. But once it's done, we're done, you know. I hit that like emotional delete key. We're over, you know. I'll never like, I don't fight with people. I don't get confrontational because I don't want the stress, you know. But, you know, I'll have my own emotional like, you know, fuck you, and then we're done.
You're done. Right.
You know, I just don't want the stress. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
You know, the one where people usually that never expected there was a time in my life where I was making my living shoeing horses.
You said that.
But most people go, you know, you used to shoot horses? No, I didn't shoot horses.
And you got paid for it?
Yeah, really. So there are a lot of those. And again, it goes back to I never shied away from hard work or trying to learn from something, you know?
Yeah.
So I had horses. I never wanted to be the guy that wanted a 2-week vacation. Mm-hmm. You know, so for me, if there was something about, let's say horses, I like to trail ride at a point, spend a bunch of time. I wanted to do that. I wanted to make it what I was doing every day.
Yeah.
See if I could make that pay off and really immerse myself in whatever it was. It turned that way in sailing and music and the things I really want to do. I don't want to work at something that I don't like to get 2 weeks to go do something that I do like. You know, I have to do that every day.
Let me ask you something. You're definitely, you know, somebody who has paid a price to do things you like. And I don't necessarily paid a bad price. I mean, put the time and work in, you know, and haven't been afraid. Like, you haven't been afraid of the hard work, like you said. What, like, where did that come from, that, hey, I want to do what I like, and that's what's, you know, that's a life philosophy, I think.
Probably, I'd have to say that probably came from my folks, you know, my mother was a real, sort of a combination. She was a real up person, but she was really wary from what she went through as a kid. But you know, she lost 3 sisters in concentration camps.
Oh my God! And
their husbands. Whoa. and she would take us back as children, kids. We'd go back northern France, and she would take us to those camps, and she would take us to those places as my brother and I, and really go. You have to learn the cause or the effect of certain actions. And in your life, you have to learn that there is an effect from everything you do. And so she sort of always instilled, be aware of what your actions can do, either as an individual or as not watching what your country does. You know, she was a real believer in that. And I think she just instilled this really view in us early of, you know, everything's not you know, lollipops and ice cream cones, but it can be, and you can choose to do it, but you have to be real careful on your decisions.
But you had the sunlight of optimism behind that message, it sounds like.
You did.
Yeah,
I mean, she was
really cool.
a believer that you can change things and do things, but she didn't ever want you going into a blind, you know, I think is what she was trying to teach, that, okay, there's a beautiful world out here. I'll give you a story on that was an influence. So I was with her. She was dying of cancer, and so I'm sitting next to her, and she was, you know, she's going out, and then she would get this like a little girl smile on her face and come up and be like right there with you. And I said, hey, you know, it's a beautiful smile. What's going on? What are you doing? She goes, I'm smuggling friendship. And I said, you're smuggling friendship. She goes, I'm smuggling friendship from behind the enemy lines. You always got to smuggle friendship.
Wow. And
she was like gone. And you know, so there was this part of her that was
That's
that was so positive,
intense,
you know,
man.
It was so positive.
Wow. Thank you, man. I'm taking a minute to process that. That's pretty intense. Thank you. Holy crap.
So wow. That's what, you know, yeah, in the end of it, she was still, you know, and they were sending her as a little girl. They were sending her because you couldn't as an adult, but they were sending her under the fences to like steal potatoes and food from the Germans and bring it back to the family. And I can't imagine.
Yeah. That's not childhood. You know? That's
yeah. No, yeah. Right.
But this was in France going on.
Yeah. World War II. Yeah.
I thought all that stuff was like in Eastern Europe, like Poland and.
No, this was, you know, they were, you know, where they are, or where I still have cousins, my family's over there. You know, like one day they were Germany, the next day they were France, you know, the line was moving over the top of them all the time. And, wow, but yeah, hard times.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that, man. That was really deep shit. I know that I know the answer to this one, but I'm going to ask you the most important person in your life.
It's Amy.
Yeah.
But that one, you know, I can't have, that's probably one I was going to say. Let's not ask that one in case other people that are important. I mean, they ought to know that, but I don't want to offend anybody else who's in my family, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, it's not like an unreasonable answer that your wife that you've been with for like 20 years or 25 years or whatever.
We've done so much, gotten ourselves in and out of a whole lot of stuff.
That's for sure. Yeah. Of course. That's pretty reasonable. Tell me the most important thing your mom taught you, I guess, was this, that you could do anything with this optimism. What's the most important thing your dad taught you?
I think from my dad is, my dad's stoic. He's just stoic. He's a pretty slight person, stoic, and he cuts to the chase. There's no bullshit with him. I mean, as a kid, there was no line for bullshit. You know, as soon as you started, he just, no, you know, there was no plan. There was just no bullshit. And I've watched him through so many things, stand for his beliefs. And he will stand for his beliefs. I mean, against the odds, he's just a stoic, realistic guy.
He's still around, your dad?
Yeah, he's 88, and in an assisted living place in Clearwater, Florida.
Right down here, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's great,
and,
man.
And yeah, he's something else.
Well, that's great.
But there was one of those that, you know, you talk to my father, there was just there was no room for bullshit or even trying. You know, you just knew he looked right through you.
Did you pick up a lot of that? So like when you're dealing with someone and they're throwing some shit your way, you could kind of smell it?
I bet I do. Yeah. You know, I've had people ask me, you know, I've had people go, you know, man, you're a little standoffish. And usually it's not that. It's a little bit of a judgment.
Yeah, it's like with you. You know? Yeah, it's some energy or vibe they're putting off. That's I get it. I totally get that, man.
But I'm not good you know, let's take it. Oh, you can take it to music or the bar room sailor. You know, you have people that haven't done anything to sit at the bar and talk about it all. I don't have much time for that.
I hear you. I know I don't have time for that. It's those are that and in today's day and age, unfortunately, with the internet, there's more of that than ever before. Everybody's an expert, you know, guitar player, marketing person, you know, and they're sitting there, they're living in their mom's. The basement of their mom's house on a couch, and they're like, their opinions are like, you know, yeah, I'm the same. I don't pay attention to much of that shit. Yeah, that's funny. What are you proudest of, musically and personally?
I think musically, probably the proudest, just that I did not let it beat me down. You know, the business side of it. It's just. I just love it. You know, I love about anything about it. How you can, you know, there was the story with that Marine. There was a song from the Captains and Cowboys record called Your Memory Wins. And that song is about, really, it was about watching my dad. My mom and dad were married 65 years. Wow. And my mom died, and she was the one who really did everything. I mean, my dad's never turned on a computer. She paid all the bills. She was that person in their relationship. And so we really we really watched, set out to write in the sort of an old country crying your beer song, and ended up writing a song that was much closer during the time of writing that song. My mom passed, so watching my dad with it. So I told basically this little story before I performed it somewhere and on the stage, and came off of that set and had this guy, I don't know how old he was, maybe in his 60s, who came up to me and out of nowhere, you know, just gives me a big hug. And he said, you know, my wife died 6 months ago, and this is the first time I've had somebody who understood, you know. And I go, oh, I go, man, you know, thanks. And again, you know, not meaning to be an egotist, but those are my proudest moments as a musician, when you can touch somebody, you know. And this guy walked out and it was like a breakthrough. He goes, man, he goes, I've been trying to get over this. That song just like somebody understands. And it sort of seemed to lift him a little bit, at least for that 3.5 minutes. But I think it was at least that evening, you know. And wow. And that's what I'm proud of. That type of thing is what I'm probably the proudest of.
And I'm going to say this to people listening, is Mike has shared a bunch of stories of – this is like the third or fourth story you shared. And I'm sure if we sat here for another hour, it'd be another three or four more about stuff you're doing, moving people. So please listen to Mike's stuff, because if you want to feel something – He's a guy that can take you on a nice journey, and I think you'll benefit. Best money you ever spent on something, Mike?
Best money I ever spent on something. You know, that Tennessean's pretty sweet.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah, I was thinking that or your boat, you know.
Yeah, the boat for sure. Best money I ever spent. Oh, that could be any number of things, but a good guitar, because it gives you so much back if you're a songwriter.
Yeah,
you know, then you just start. It grows, you know. It's a thing that grows, and the boat. Definitely, we've had boats. That boats are a funny thing. Offshore sailing boats, to me, they are not an inanimate thing. You know, it may sound strange, but a heart and soul in those things. And when they get you, you know, the whole thing is take care of them, take care of them, take care of the boat, because the boat will take care of you. And we've had that happen a lot of times where I go, man, this thing. And they just sort of knew, you know, there are times where we're getting beat up and we're low on energy, we're low everything, and the boat just, man, drives you through.
Well, I was thinking that because when you were talking about when you were in the Atlantic and in the crazy seas or hurricanes, it's got to have there's got to be something to that thing that's helping you help navigate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't know what it is, but anybody who's spent a lot of time and been through a bunch with a boat is the same way. You know, it comes down to that sailor superstition thing, I guess. But you know, but it's a real personal feeling with your boat.
Any hobbies besides boating or interests outside of music?
You know, I tend to go all in. At one time I rode motorcycles long distance, had horses for a while, rode them long distance. I've always been intrigued by having this thing that could be part of your life, you know, that you could, like a boat, you live on it, but you can move it. You don't like your neighbors? Well, untie it and go somewhere else, you know? And motorcycles and horses sort of follow that. I guess that's a theme I haven't thought of before, but that's a big part of it. And, you know, and in a lot of ways, guitars are like that. I heard a line actually from the other guitar player in my band. We were talking about this stuff, and he says, I guess for me, he goes, I've been chasing guitars all my life. And I thought that sums it up pretty well.
There's, you know, a song in there, Mike.
Yeah. But those guitars for me have walked me into doors I could not buy my way through. You know, you're walking with a guitar, if you find you're playing in a kitchen somewhere in Spain, they've just got me into so many great situations.
Man, I'm going to ask you three more questions. Favorite place you've traveled? You've been literally all over in all sorts of situations. What are some of the cooler things, that memories you keep with that?
All right, here's one, and it comes back to the guitar thing. So we were in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I really love Nova Scotia.
Man, you like cold places.
Not really. I mean,
Newfoundland. How it went. Newfoundland is freaking ice cold. Halifax.
This is part of. Yeah, this is part of that same trip.
This is a He-Man we're talking to, everybody.
We went left to Great Lakes. I learned how to sail into Great Lakes. Mm. Went down the Erie Canal to the Hudson, and most people beeline it south. And really, we took a left turn and went to get immersed in the music of Cape Breton and Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. The music scene up there is just phenomenal. It's sort of akin to the Appalachian scene, where you go to a little, you know, Sunday event, little family thing. There's nobody from the outside, and there'll be a family band, you know, some 5-year-old girl blowing the doors off a film.
Oh, bluegrassers or something.
That type of stuff, and the Celtic side of it. So we're in Halifax, which is a fun sailor's town, and we're ready to go, and it has been really foggy up there. So we said, no matter what, we are leaving on the morning tide, which was like 5 a.m., and we are getting out of here, and we're not getting caught up in this town anymore. It's been fun, but we're leaving. So we walk down the dock. The other side of the dock, there's a boat, and on the sail cover, really small, all it says is Russia. Russia. This is interesting. Then a couple guys come off the boat and start talking to them. Then they invite us on the boat, and it turns out it's a 40-foot steel boat that a group of fathers and sons had built. To follow in the wake of Columbus. It's pretty interesting. So we go in, and we were in Halifax, and I forget what year that was, but there's all these boats coming in that were doing this sort of following in the wake of Columbus. And there was a big Polish tall ship was near us, and the Poles weren't getting along with the Russians too well. But all these people were there there's no politics going on. It's just people in the sea. So they bring us on the boat, and we're playing, and the one guy, we start talking about music, and I said, where do you play music? Could you bring your guitar over? And they bring over a guitar that during the course of crossing the ocean, somebody came through a hatch and put their foot through the top. Okay. So it was shot. It was no good. I said, okay. So there was, I go in it, and it's to get that old Martin. You get my Martin. And there is a guy on the Polish ship who's an American guy, Simon Spalding, who's sort of a music maritime, I mean, history guy. Mm-hmm. And they have him with the Poles, and he's playing a bunch of their music. He's playing a bunch of American old-time sort of working history stuff. He's a fiddle player. And he you know, sort of leans over, and he goes, where are you going? I said, going. He sees it with the guitar. I said, heading to the Russian boat. He goes, you think you can talk me on? I'll get my fiddle. I said, yeah, sure. Seems to be a really friendly thing. And we go on, and there's like 14 of these guys. And then we spent an evening passing the guitar, and I was playing – and I wasn't really looking to play my stuff. I was looking to play a little bit. You know, I'd play like some Neil Young, something. I'd play some Doc Watson, something, so they'd hear USA. And they were playing these Russian folk songs that were, tear your heart out, make you cry. Yeah. But that was such a magical evening of cultures. And needless to say, the captain keeps filling up our glass with vodka. So that was a vodka front.
There's a vodka front and, came in.
And I mean, and Amy and I crawled across the dock onto our boat. We didn't leave the next morning, needless to say. And
you didn't make that 5 a.m. run.
No. And those bastards were on the dock at like sunrise doing calisthenics and stuff. I mean, they put us under the table. It was great. So then that one, the captain comes up. I mean, this is like way broken English. And asked me if I had any charts, nautical charts of the area. And I said, yeah. But I mean, for us, you know, we were doing this on a shoestring budget. So I lent him the chart. He goes, I'm going to go out. There's a he goes, like 100 miles out, there's a Russian fishing trawler. He goes, let me go get some fresh fish. I want to come back here and do and grill this fish for all my new friends in Halifax. So, all right. So it's our only chart. He goes, and I'm figuring, I lost that chart, but last night was worth it. The experience was worth it. And, late that evening, he comes sailing back in with all this fresh fish, and they set up this whole thing for everybody on the dock. I mean, that was, you know, you can't buy that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
The experience was great. So that was a good one. And another was, we really like Spain. The nightlife in Spain is great. I like being a musician. You know, it really closes for the heat, but the restaurants start opening up at 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night. And one of the ways
they open at 10 or 11 at night.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they'll be packed till 1, 2 in the morning.
Wow. That's really cool.
But you go to eat dinner at 7 o'clock, there's nothing open. I mean, they just, you know, it's closed for a big part of it's so hot. It's a real nightlife.
That's culture. Interesting. I never heard of that. That's really interesting. Very cool.
So that worked for us. But one of the ways I try to immerse myself sailing with people is this is how it happened in Spain, but I've done this all over. So we're going in. I don't go to yacht clubs. I don't go to the fancy places. I try to go to more to a working harbor.
Yeah.
So we pulled in, and there's a little boat yard, and we anchored out, and we would dink into there and go into this little town of El Rompido, and go into there, and the mechanic, he's doing this big job on a boat. So I would go in, and he didn't speak, you know, I spoke hardly any Spanish. He didn't speak much English. But you go in, and you see he's lifting something heavy, and I would go and, like, help him do that and work with him for a few hours, not ask for anything, you know, and then see the project and get immersed with him and give him a week's worth of labor putting an engine in or doing whatever. Well, really quickly, you become friends, and that one turned into he invited us to his house. He knew Thanksgiving was a big deal for us.
Right.
Didn't know quite what it was. So would you come to our house for Thanksgiving? So, yeah, sure. So we come, he has his whole family to, like, meet the foreigners.
new puppy.
Yeah, exactly. And Amy bakes two pumpkin pies.
Oh, you know,
We're out at the anchorage. She bakes them in a kerosene oven we had on that boat. And we come in with the pies. But we're sitting around, and everybody's, you know, got whatever they're using for a translator, their phone or a book or whatever. And he goes, okay, Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is, let me think, Thanksgiving is Indians and fireworks. No, it's like a mix.
You're on the right track. Keep going. Do a little more research.
And those type things. You know, So wherever I go, I bring in a guitar, play some songs, and then you find somebody else plays a little bit. It's just those cultural things are beautiful. And to me, that refreshes me on that positiveness of life.
Yeah.
Walking into those, you know, so you go, man, people are people everywhere.
Is that like the common thing? Like when you're docking where there is this instant, hey, I'm here, you're here, let's hang out, let's learn about each other. Is that pretty common?
It's pretty common. I mean, if you're outside the big yachty areas,
yeah,
you know, the yachty areas, you have whoever it is. If it's Americans, go to hang out with more Americans. Well, why go to Spain and hang out with Americans?
No, I told you. Yeah.
In America, yeah. You know, and but it's a pretty common thread of long distance cruising sailors. You make friends pretty quick.
Yeah, I always like, if wherever I go, I like to go to the, like, where are the locals eating?
I
want to find that out, because I don't want to go to the tourist spots, because it's just going to be a fake thing, overpriced. I want to find out what do the locals eat, what do the locals drink, what do they like to do, and just mingle. I think that's a lot more of a, it's just a better experience, you know.
Yeah, it's a real experience.
Yeah, you don't want to go drive or fly or, you know, sail somewhere and then, like, do something. You can go to Orlando in Disney World. You know, it's like going to France in Disney World. And oh, this is what it's like in Paris. No, this is a fucking tourist shop, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's nothing remotely.
Same thing. People go, oh, you know, I saw the Eiffel Tower in Vegas.
No, I hear you. I find that really funny, that kind of stuff. It's entertaining, but that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Two more questions. Toughest decision you ever had to make, or the hardest thing you ever had to do? And in a lifetime of them, I know there's a lot.
Those are tough questions. To narrow it down to one, there have been.
I know. Imagine if you only had one, right? How good would that be? What a nice, easy life.
You know, I guess I think for me it comes down and it covers a few different things. It is the decision that, you know, I'll steal the phrase from Tom Petty, the decision on a number of things that I won't back down from it. When you are leaving shore for the next month crossing an ocean, there's a point where you're going, if I don't make it to the other side, am I being fair to the rest of my family? Am I being fair to fans? Am I being fair to Amy? Am I doing this? And somewhere you go, I'm going to gain so much from this, and this is a personal challenge that I want to do. And you dig down and you go, yes, this is what I'm going to do. You know, a decision of believing in yourself with music. There's been a lot. This new record has been, you know, walking out of that studio in Austin and paying for that for a week and the producer, because, hey, you know, I hired him. But to go, no, you guys don't have a clue what I'm trying to get across, and I'm going to pay it because I don't like not paying if I say I'm going to pay.
Yeah.
And walking out and going, whoa, that was a losing proposition. But not really. Yeah, I learned from that one. I learned, okay, you know, I'm done looking for producers. I can make this record exactly how I want it. I just have to believe that. That's the decision I have to make. You know, just those are the ones where you really got to, you really sort of got to look inside yourself and say, yes, I can, or I can't, and believe that.
And, you know, and I give you credit, because I think a big portion of being able to make those hard decisions goes back to something we talked about earlier, is willingness to take responsibility for yourself and the outcome.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because if you can't do that, you really can't do those other things. It's like literally impossible.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So I give you credit, man. Last question, and I really appreciate everything, man. I really enjoyed this. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this change has been deliberate and how much is just a part of aging?
One is, and it goes to a professional life on the music side, I guess, is I tended to be a little bit standoffish. You know, really came from the country, liked it that way. We moved from, you know, having a ton of acres with nobody around to being on a boat where you could be 1,000 miles from anybody. You know, that's a real part of my nature.
Yeah.
And really coming to Nashville, doing a lot of stuff and having a manager that was going, you have a story to tell. Don't be ashamed of that story. And you need to learn how to just be open quicker with people. And that was a tough one. And how do I get that across on, let's say you're doing performing arts theater type of night. You're doing 2 50-minute sets. Well, somewhere you've got to get a hold of those people within the first 15 minutes, 20 minutes and let them know you're sincere. And start to give them something, be open to it. So there's been a little bit of learning how to do that. And once that sort of shell opened up, it became much easier. But that was a real conscious effort to do.
Congrats. Well, I'll tell you what, you have been open as anybody I could have asked for here. So whatever you're doing is working, man.
You know, and on that one, you know, there are two people that I saw that were real influential on that. One is Arlo Guthrie.
Sure.
I watched him do a show where he's real open at the end of the show. I mean, he does it to this day. End of the show, he goes, I'm going to be outside in the, you know, in the back alley. Anybody wants to come and talk to me, man, love to see you. And I'm going, for the days of rock stars, you know, and here, and I go to the, you know, this guy does this all his life. And you talk about anything. And I go, that's really cool. And I think that the other one.
Did you do that? Did you do that?
Yeah, go around and talk to him, you mean?
No. Did you
do that?
Yeah, did you do that?
Yeah.
And I'll
always make myself open. And usually, you know, you end up with sort of lifelong fans and friends out of that. You know, they go, huh.
People want to talk to you. Grateful as hell.
Yeah, the guy that came up and, you know, and talked about his wife dying. Mm. You know, just making yourself available. Yeah. I mean, you go to a show, you're expecting people to shell out their hard-earned money to see you, and at the point where they really feel, I guess, they're getting their money's worth, or that you're really sincere, it crosses a boundary
between huge.
Just being the musician and them being the audience, you know? And in younger days, playing rock, that was the whole thing, you know, a Zeppelin day, it was to build that wall. There was them, there was us, you know? And then getting older, going, no, that's not what I don't want a them and us at all.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I want us all here together being part of this experience, and I'm gaining from them too, you know?
Yeah.
So, I've seen another guy who's great at it is, people hate him 'cause he's so successful, but is Buffett. I mean, I saw, you know, Buffett do that same thing of just making you, and read a thing of Buffett, that what he tries to do is have it so that not much time, you know, he's giving you the feel like you're at some anchorage and he's sitting in your cockpit playing you a song.
Yeah.
You know, there might be how many ever thousands, but you feel he's singing to you. And I thought, that's an art form I want to learn.
Very cool, man.
I mean, it's got to be sincere, but you still have to, you can't be shy. You have to learn how to do that with people. But
you're not that guy though. You can't be insincere. I mean, I don't know you well, but you're not going to be insincere. That's just not your deal. Man. You can't go out there and just like you know, bullshit it and looking at the clock. I mean, that's just not you. So that's not really an issue. You know, who's always been like that their whole career. And cause I've followed him his whole career is Warren Haynes.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And man, I remember, I've seen them like five times. I saw him at the Beacon a couple of times with Mule with the brothers, and I've seen him a lot of times solo. I went to a show with my older son, Nick. Man, this is 15 years ago, maybe. He was down here in Tampa at the Tampa Theater, and we waited outside, and I just couldn't believe it. Was, you know, they play 3 hour set, and they're killing it for 3 hours. It's not you know, that's he's.
And, he's not phoning it in.
No, man, that guy's crushing it. And then he just hangs out, and he's patient, and he's so grateful. And I was amazed. I couldn't believe it was like the patience of a saint. The guy had, you know, and just talked to people and hello and thank you. And he was thanking us, you know. And he's like, it's 1:30 in the morning.
To me, that's the mark of a gracious person who's, you know, appreciative of where they are and a professional. I mean, you see so many that don't do that. And to me, okay, you're a career musician and that's sort of it. But then you have the ones like you're talking about, that's more than a profession. I mean, it's who you are. It's what you do. You couldn't do anything else. You know, I do these songwriters workshops at the Aiken and Friends Fest. And I do workshops all over and a lot with kids, you know, and you'll have somebody comes up, hey, I'm going to be a musician I figure if I'm not a star in 3 years, I go, well, let's, you know,
do you laugh at them when they say that?
Yeah, I do.
It's actually quite funny though. You have to,
you know, I go, but if it's the first thing you think of when you get up and it's the last thing. So I always go, you know, your guitar should be on a stand in your bedroom. So, you know, if it's the last thing you think of, you look at your guitar before you go to sleep and that's all what it is. Well, then let's talk because you're addicted. You know, for me, that I always tell people that one too. I am so thrilled that music and guitars were not, you know, some nasty drug because I've been addicted to this from like the first day, you know, they've gotten me through a whole lot of things that
really were weighing heavily on you. Yeah, no, I totally hear you, man. And the flip side of that is what you just a reference about hanging out after the show. The upside to you is, gosh, you're going to have lifelong fans, like you said. I mean, who is not going to want to have every opportunity to see you play in concert, support your music, tell all their friends when you're that cool guy that hangs out and like spent 5 minutes and let the guy hug you and you talked about that moment that you were able to help him share. I mean, that's incredible, man. Man, I want to, you talked about Aiken and friends. First of all, I can't thank you enough, Mike. You've been so generous with your time and I really genuinely enjoyed talking with you, but I want to tell people where they could find you and how they need to connect with you. First of all, it's Mike Aiken, AIKEN. I want you to check out his new album. It's his seventh record. He's got a hell of a catalog. It's called Wayward Troubadour, and you can find it a lot of places. The best place to check him out is on his website, which is Mike Aiken Music. Again, it's Mike, AIKEN, music.com. And he's got links to he's got a really robust website. He's got links to everything there, and you can check out if you want to stream, you can go to, he's got his own channel on Pandora and on Spotify. And of course you could buy it in all the usual places and just go to his website. I'll have all the links there. Talk about, I think you have a vinyl album coming out soon for the first time.
Yeah, I do. It'll be the Wayward Troubadour record, but we decided, I mean, that was part of my thing with producers on this is they wanted to, you know, I did not want to make a record full of singles. I wanted to make a record. I wanted to make a record that had started and ended and took you in a journey through it. And part of that was to put out the vinyl side of it that was an actual record. And it's becoming so popular these days.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a good one. So that's coming out. We're hoping. It's funny. All the pressing plants are back ordered. It's getting so hot by 4 or 5 months.
It's like 1978 again, right?
It is. It is.
Wild.
But it was fun, you know, the process of having, you know, the artwork for it. Of, you know, he had to remaster for vinyl over digital. There was a lot of stuff that I ran into that I didn't think you'd have to do. But, you know, I went to the vinyl plant. They're going, well, you know, the low end you can put into digital or a CD will blow the needle out of the groove.
You know, interesting.
The volume that you do digital music at will blow the needle out of the groove. There was just a whole lot of, you know, sort of that geekdom stuff to make a good record that was fun to go through.
Very cool, man. And talk about, you have a charity called Aiken and Friends. This is your 13th annual Aiken and Friends event. It's taking place September 20th. It's 2021 and 22.
That's correct.
In central New Jersey. And I'd like a lot of people to attend that if they can. Talk about that. What made you get into it? What does the charity do? And talk about the event itself.
It started in Southern Virginia. And really, it started for me. I was sailing from the Bahamas, actually to Maine, up the East Coast. And looking at, you know, a sailboat goes 5-6 miles an hour. You know, they're not fast. So you have time to think. And seeing all the variety of music on the East Coast, I think it's just such a wealth of music. So thinking, oh, it'd be fun to put together a festival that was all about the music and the musicians compared to a lot of festivals I get booked at that are, you know, the music's the background to other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So we came in, it ended up being done. We outran a hurricane on the Chesapeake and found this little town of Smithfield, Virginia. And that's where we started it. And in that, there was a couple that had a not-for-profit thing for youth music education, which really suited me well. So we partnered up, and that sort of started it. That ran there for 12 years. 2 years ago, this community college in Branchburg, New Jersey, I played their theater, and he started talking. He goes, yeah, we could do that. So that worked into – this is the second year up there. And what it is anything that's made on the festival – goes to supporting scholarships for the music department in that community college.
Wow. So you give 100% of the profits?
Yeah. I mean,
holy
musicians
smoke.
Get paid. It's not the musicians.
Yeah, sure.
But anything gets made. There was I was booked to play as a part of this college, Raritan Valley Community College is a beautiful theater. So I was booked in with the band to play the theater. Then at the end of the night, talking to the presenter, he started asking about the festival in Virginia. So he said, yeah, that'd be a cool thing to bring to the campus. I think this would work. So he came down for 3 years to Virginia to just watch it, be part of it. And then, you know, said, hey, give me a number to bring this up. So it's been a good thing. This will be the second year.
That's great.
Up that way. And the benefit of that one, because he liked the youth music education part. And I really wanted to have in a festival that had my name on it, a way to give back. Music is really sort of kept me focused in especially in young years, you know, it really kept me from going down roads that wouldn't have been good to go down.
I
never wanted to get past a point where anything affected my music adversely, you know, so it just kept me from being in the ditch.
It saved your life in a sense.
Yeah. You know, so I just think it's a good thing, and I wanted to give back. And when he came up with, well, here's what we can do at the college, is anything we make goes to doing scholarships for the music department. And he goes, you know, there are so many talented people that come through, and once they're accepted, they can't afford it, and they don't come in. So it was a good fit.
It's really, you know, cool.
It was a good fit.
So, really cool.
Yeah, that's something I believe in.
And where can people find info about this? Is this on your website?
They can go to my website, which is MikeAikenMusic.com, and Aiken is spelled A-I-K-E-N, or they can go to, it's all spelled out, AikenAndFriendsFest.com.
And that takes place again September 20th, 21st, and 22nd, which is like a few weeks from today when you're here.
Yeah, not far. Yep.
That's awesome. And it's the 13th event. So if you believe in, you know, supporting music and you want to support one of the good guys out there, go check it out. And if you're in the Central Jersey area, for sure. Also, Mike's touring schedule. You're getting ready to go out. Where are you going to be September, October? I know you're going over to Europe soon.
Yeah, September we're going to be, and they can find, again, all this on the website. But September, at the end of this week, we're running to Texas, and we've got two shows in Texas. Then we run from Texas to Kansas City, Missouri. And then out of Kansas City, we run to Atlanta, Georgia. And then back up to Nashville, playing a show in Nashville, and back to Virginia.
Man, that's a lot of time not on your boat. How are you going to handle
it? Yeah, all moving. We're in a bus, you know, a small, funky little bus. Not, you know, it's not people, oh, they got the big tour bus. No, it's just some funky little bus we got. But that's fine. As long as we're moving, I'm good with it.
I hear you. And again, you could check out Mike's touring schedule on his website, Mike Aiken Music. And also, you can hit him up on social media, on Instagram. He's at Aiken Music, Aiken Mike, A-I-K-E-N Mike. And on Facebook, it's Mike Aiken Music. Man, I can't thank you enough for everything. Did I miss anything? Anything else that we need to tell people about?
No, I think this has been very enjoyable. No, I think you covered all the bases. So I guess you got a little insight to who I am and why I make the music I make.
And I'm really happy I did that. And I really appreciate your time. And thank you for everything. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks so much again to Mike Aiken for spending time with us. Please support him and check out all the cool music that he's making at MikeAikenMusic.com and look for his most recent album, Wayward Troubadour. It's an awesome record and he knows how to move people. Make sure you go to EveryoneLovesGuitar.com, sign up to our newsletter list right now. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.